B-Pod Studios.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.
Today on Talkin' Rock with Meltdown.
Lots going on in Talkin' Rock with Meltdown today. Joe Satriani joins us first to discuss his new album and what it's called.
The album is actually called Shape Shifting.
I'll get into that here in just a couple minutes. Joe's talking guitarists are real legends, like Kirk Hammett from Metallica. And with the anniversary of Master of Puppets upon us, I asked him about that classic album.
But its importance and how it influenced a generation of thrashers, you know.
Oh, and I kind of seem to stump Joe on one question.
Wow. No one has ever asked me that question before. This is like a first.
That's just for starters with Joe Satriani. Then Henry Paul from the Outlaws joins me. They have a new album out. It's called Dixie Highway.
And I think we succeeded in making a really honest and very human musical presentation.
We talk about the Super Bowl halftime show, even new bands on the scene.
Go make it and put it out there and roll the dice and take your chance and have some fun with it.
And that's just for starters with Henry Paul from the Outlaws and Joe Satriani today on Talkin' Rock with Meltdown.
This is Talkin' Rock. Talkin' Rock. Your backstage pass to some of your favorite rock artists. Here's your host, Meltdown.
As I like to start out each episode of Talkin' Rock with Meltdown, thank you so much for listening. It means a lot to me that you check this podcast out. And by the way, if you do and you like it, give it a 5-star rating on Apple and iTunes and the whole thing. And share it with your friends and subscribe as well, because we have a lot of great interviews coming up. I know I'll be talking to Tom Kiefer here, from Cinderella, but I'm doing his solo thing, which is just awesome. I've seen him, I think, 3 times in the last year. And Tom is just great, not only to see live in concert. If you're looking for like a real musician, you might think to yourself, Cinderella, you know, but no, real musician, plays all the instruments, sings all the songs. There's no backing tracks up on stage. It's just like, give it a chance. Check out Tom's latest solo album, Rise. It's kick ass. Hey, coming up here in a few minutes, Henry Paul from the Outlaws, like I mentioned in the intro. But first up, it's Joe Satriani, and his new record drops coming up on April 10th. And he was supposed to call in the day before I recorded this interview. And I don't know, due to some sort of mix-up, he called in a day late, which we get into here in a few minutes. And it's kind of funny because he called me out on the name of the record. I don't know why I had the album Shape Shifter in my mind. I think it's because of the story I talk about with Billy Corgan in the interview that he says he saw one or became one or something like that. Anyways, so that kind of stuck in my mind. And you know what? Here's the thing with my podcast. If this is your first time listening, or even if it's not, it's like I kind of like to leave a lot of that stuff in there. I very rarely edit this podcast as far as the content with the artist goes, unless like a phone drops or something. Just doing the interview with Josie Scott last week from Saliva, and my Pro Tools just stopped working. I did edit that up. You know, there was an episode last year with Slash where the phone call just dropped out, and I edited that up as well. But I like to keep this stuff in there, warts and all. Yeah, even when I screw up the name of the artist record. Listen, I do a lot of these interviews, okay? I can't be on top of everything 100% of the time. But Joe is such a professional and such a great guy. And, of course, he corrected me, and then we moved on. Joe Satriani today, right here on the Talkin' Rock with Meltdown podcast. Enjoy.
It's me. How's it going?
Hey, it's going good, man. A day late, but still good nonetheless.
That's right.
Yeah, no problem at all. So good to hear from you, man. So let's talk about this new record. Drops on April 10th, Shapeshifter. I have to admit that the first time I heard the title of this record, I immediately thought like of that Billy Corgan interview where he was talking about where he'd seen a shapeshifter. Have you ever been abducted by aliens?
No. You know, I thought when I was young, I thought that'd be really cool. And I was waiting and waiting. And then finally I realized I don't think there are any aliens. People are just nervous. That's all. And they invent things. But yeah, no. So the album is actually called Shape Shifting.
Oh, Shape Shifting. Okay, see, there you go. Well, there's the whole big thing there. There you go. All right.
Yeah, my bad. Know. See, it's part of my style to confuse my audience.
I guess I was confused. Right. I even listened to interviews and stuff with you, as a matter of fact, with Steve Black, one of my coworkers. And Shape Shifting. Okay. So yeah, I can just erase all the surfing with the alien questions then.
That's okay.
So anyway, Shape Shifting. I wrote it down wrong here. April 10th. And the first single is 1980. Obviously the song has a little bit of, a retro feel to it, but why 1980 and not 84 or 78 or whatever?
Yeah, I know. That's a big question. Well, last year we put out finally the very first and only Squares album. And the Squares was a band I was in from late 79 to about early 85. We went absolutely nowhere. We worked really hard. We tried to be a famous rock band, but we just never got the break. And me and the guys that were in that band, save the bass player, are still around, and we still work together. Jeff Campitelli was the drummer, and my longtime collaborator, co-producer, engineer, John Cunaberdy, was our studio and live sound engineer. So, every year that we get together to do an album, we'd say, hey, when are we going to do that Squares album? So, anyway, we finally did it last year. We got a record deal. Only took 39 years,
yeah, right.
But we got a record deal. And when it was all over, I thought, what was it that I didn't do in that band that I always thought I wanted to do when we got started? And, it was, we kind of dialed back our talent a little bit to try to fit into the new wave scene. But I was the guy that really was into Sabbath and Zeppelin and Hendrix. I just wanted to rock a little bit more than we did. And so I just thought I should just write this song, get it off my chest. It's a total throwback. And it wasn't quite, 1980 wasn't as shreddy as like 84, 85 or
right.
88, but by the middle of the 80s, guitar players just decided to just throw the kitchen sink at every song, But in 1980, it was still, Eddie Van Halen being cool, sitting on the backbeat, playing amazing guitar, and Billy Gibbons. And, there was still Fleetwood Mac and Dire Straits in the air, it was not as crazy. So I would just thought, wow, I'm just going to write a song about that, about how I felt being in a power pop trio in 1980 and what I wanted to do. And now that I've done it, I can move forward, finally.
Yeah, I can do something about 1990 or something on the next record. So, yeah, so, you're talking about that. So as a guitar player, and you're a little bit older than I am, but as a guitar player growing up in that era, what do you think, the first thing that pops into my head is like Yngwie. Where do you think that the shredding started, and who may have precipitated it?
Well, the shredding thing probably started hundreds of years ago with the classical players. There were some classical players that were just total shredders, Franz Liszt, Beethoven. They were just, they introduced a whole other physical way of playing, and that got into the jazz world. And then you had bebop players that just went totally crazy, crazy with being able to take their technical prowess to the highest possible level and make it musical. And even though, as Bird was at the height of playing his alto sax in the world of jazz and bebop, there was Elvis Presley and Rock Around the Clock that was, taking the youth culture by storm. But it eventually bled into these guitar players that wanted to really shred. And I think by 1970, you started to see the Al DiMeola, the Alan Holdsworth, the John McLaughlin, and they were totally shredding. But they were plugged into Marshalls, and they were, they were turning it up just like Jimmy Page and Eric Clapton and Jimi Hendrix. And I think that's where it started. And then the next generation, which was me and Yngwie, Steve Vai, Eddie Van Halen, we just thought, well, that's normal, so let's just start there,
Yeah.
And so for us, shredding doesn't really, I think we all scratched our heads and we went like, what? We're just playing, We're not shredding. Mm. We're just playing. So
what was your, what's your favorite memory of 1980?
I think it's playing all those clubs. We were excited about the bands that were coming out that sounded so different. You know, you could go see Blondie and Gang of Four. You know, you could see Ozzy playing. It was unfortunately, you know, the end of Led Zeppelin. There were some tragedies that rocked the world, like John Lennon getting shot and John Bonham passing away. But there was hope that something new was going to happen, and it got a little bit more electronic, I think, than what we expected. But at the same time, here's the interesting thing. I was teaching guitar at a little guitar store in Berkeley, California, at the same time that I was in the square. So I'm playing clubs at night, but teaching during the daytime. And who are my students? They are the next generation that are going to change the world.
Right.
Kirk Hammack, Alex Skolnick, Larry Lalonde, David Bryson, Kevin Cadogan. You know, they're just unbelievable musicians that have their own idea about shredding or not shredding and rocking or not rocking, whatever. And, you know, by the time I finally released Surfing with the Alien, I'd already been teaching Kirk for quite a while. He'd already been in Metallica and released quite a few albums. So it was like I already knew that the new reality of rock music had already happened. You know, it was so from 80 to 88. Wow, that was very exciting.
Yeah, by the way, the right answer is Miracle on Ice, but for the best memory of 1980. But exactly. So, yeah, growing up in Berkeley, California, I'm sure that was high on your list of things to watch in February of 1980 or whatever it was. But so you brought it up, Kirk Hammett. I mean, obviously, you know, it's no secret that you taught him and stuff. And Master of Puppets just celebrated its anniversary the other day. Where do you rank that record? I mean, metal fans and stuff say it may be the best album. I mean, what are your thoughts on that record?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's sometimes you don't know how great a record is. Because at the time it gets released, I think the perception of it is somewhat marred by expectation and how it relates to the records, you know, that get released that very same year. But then after time goes by, you begin to see, you know, what records were kind of just trendy and maybe not that good, and what records just keep getting better. And that's one of those records that just keeps getting better, and people start to realize it's not only it's good all on its own, and but its importance and how it influenced a generation of thrashers. You know, I mean, it was just so strong. You know, and the songs were strong, and it just sort of created a genre, or crystallized the genre. I got to say that because I think Kill 'Em All kind of created the genre, but that record perhaps, you know, was the first time that they crystallized it. I mean, Metallica has done that a few times.
Yeah,
you know, pretty amazing. But that perhaps was that first crystallization where it was just so definitive.
Yeah, it's amazing some of the guys that you taught, and you've probably heard this question before, but could you foresee any of these guys becoming monster players in the industry like they have become?
I did, you know, and it's funny that you should ask me that, because I remember going back to rehearsals in the early 80s, you know, and telling my other guys, I said, you know, there are these kids I'm teaching during the daytime, and they are going to change the world. And I play them something, and they don't look at me like, no one's going to ever listen to that. That'll never be on the radio. They'll never get past, you know, playing community centers and, you know, Sundays at the park. And I'm like, are you guys crazy? Because, I mean, when I would sit across from guys like Alex Skolnick or Kirk Hammett, I could tell that they were turning into geniuses, they were turning into super talents, and I didn't see anything standing in their way, but I couldn't convince my older friends that it was happening. I think perhaps they were resistant to it because it wasn't their style, maybe they were threatened or something, but because I was a teacher, I wasn't threatened. As a matter of fact, I was like, I was the big cheerleader, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
I was
yeah.
the one who was saying, come on, let's do it. I knew they could do it. It never entered my mind that they would not be able to achieve what they wanted to do, because they were, you know, they had the three important things. They had the physical talent, they had the intellect, they were smart, and they had the heart. Their heart was in the right place. They really were great students. They practiced hard. They knew what they wanted, and they wanted to change the world, and they just had that right amount of anger
yeah.
at the older generation that's so necessary when you're that young, you know. and they wanted to change the world, and they did. So, yeah, that's great.
Now, outside of, like, charity events and different things that you might have done with these guys in the past years, have you ever had a chance to play with any of their bands?
Not with the bands, let's say, on stage at the same time. I mean, Metallica has had us open up. I think the last time we opened up for them was for that unbelievable, like, 120,000 people in Quebec City. That was so much fun. That was just great, you know. They've been always very gracious to us. I had Alex Skolnick on stage about a year and a half ago on a G3 when we passed through New Jersey, and he was able to come out on stage and jam with me and John Petrucci and Phil Collins. And I think we had Glenn Hughes came out that night, too, and sang for us. So that was fun, you know. But, yeah, not enough of it, you know. I mean, I put G3 together because I always felt there's just not enough camaraderie between lead guitar players, you know. They tend to be standoffish and try to protect their territory, and I'm the other way. I'm like, no, come on, let's mix it up. The audience already knows who their favorite is, so don't worry about that. Let's just have some fun. Let's maybe we can all learn how to play better if we stand next to each other and do it, you know, in front of an audience. So, you know, Kirk's cool with that, and Alex has been great with that. He's an amazing musician, you know. So I wish it happened more.
Now, what do you like? What's a better dichotomy for you, being in a band-type setting or just kind of being the guy and doing your own solo stuff?
Yeah, I mean, boy, yeah, I miss, you know, when I'm in a band, I miss that thing. Like when, you know, we go to India and I play Flying in the Blue Dream and the entire 40,000 people are singing the melody. I mean, it's really hard to replace the rush you get from that and think that an audience around the world has memorized your guitar melody. That's pretty fascinating. But at the same time, when I've been in Deep Purple, when I played with Mick Jagger and spent a lot of time with Chickenfoot, it was so much fun to take three steps back and hang with the drummer and not have to be the guy out front. You know, it's not my natural inclination to be the lead singer guy, you know. And when you have a talent who was born to be a lead singer, you know, like Sammy Hagar, there's nothing quite like it, you know, to have that lead singer in front of you commanding the audience and being able to play. You know, it's sort of like the difference from being the Jimi Hendrix figure in a band, or, you know, where you're the thing, you're the focus of all the attention, or Jimmy Page, where you know, you've got a lead singer and you can hang back with John Bonham and really rock out. And I kind of miss that, you know, like playing with Chad and just playing rhythm guitar is really a thrill. When the rocking's good, it's really great.
Yeah, and of course, you know, Chad's from here. And, you know, Sammy and Michael and Chad, they're so hard to work with. So you're probably looking for time to get away from them, right?
I know, it is too much fun.
I can imagine.
That's what wears you out. Certainly not the playing. It's just too many good times, you know.
Yeah, no doubt. So, you know, it's funny because I was supposed to talk to you yesterday, like we kind of alluded to at the beginning, and I just happened to be flipping through my Facebook waiting for your call, and one of my friends put on Facebook that Prince Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, When My Guitar Gently Weeps. Have you ever seen something so awesome?
Well, you know, that song is so inspirational. It seems like every time someone goes to play that thing, they channel, you know, that moment that is so odd. I mean, when you think about the story about that song, that just the fact that Clapton's playing on it on the original version, and you know, the story goes, I'm not quite sure if it's true, but that Clapton played so well and so in tune that they were afraid it didn't sound enough like the Beatles, so they used that automatic double tracking thing on the Apple mixing board to alter his pitch so that the whole thing would warble the way they were used to hearing it all warble. So, but what a beautiful sounding track, and just the power of that song. It shows you, first of all, what a genius George Harrison was, but how the Beatles affected people, and to this day, so that when Prince gets up there and plays something like that, he brings it to a new level.
Yeah. Hey, do you got time for just a couple more quick questions?
Sure.
Okay. First of all, I just want to ask you, I saw that the lead singer of Anthrax is going to be in a Journey cover band, which is like the craziest thing. So if you could be in a cover band, like, I mean, obviously you did the Hendrix thing and stuff like that, but what band would you cover?
Wow. No one has ever asked me that question before. This is like a first.
I know. I try to get different things. I know you do these interview junkets. So what do you got? What do you say?
Well, yes, a really good question. Well, first of all, I pick something easy. There's nothing worse than somebody saying, you know, like if you, you know, you get put in a band and you've got to cover someone and that's really difficult, you know. Like when I was playing with Deep Purple, it was actually really hard to sort of imitate Ritchie Blackmore because he's so idiosyncratic, you know. He's a great musician, but he just doesn't play like anybody. So you go to play his stuff and you go like, wow, that's weird. Like everything's weird, you know. So yeah, I'd probably pick like a Stones cover band because it's just so much fun, you know. You can have a drink and a smoke and, and play any of the songs and they sound fun, you know.
Now, when was the last time you saw a musician and you were like wowed by them? Like, I mean, like blown away.
Let's see. I was down in Los Angeles not too long ago for the NAMM show, and I was standing on stage next to Steve Vai and Yvette Young and Paul Gilbert and, you know, the whole band, and those guys are amazing. And but Nita Strauss, she was really good, you know. She really brought it. You know, she's like the whole thing. You know, she's got a sound and her technique's amazing. And she's a really great performer. And it was really cool to see her just be able to flow with older players like myself and Steve and Paul and the younger players like Yvette and the guys from Polyphony. I just thought it was kind of cool. I just thought, well, that's a mark of someone who's going to go really far, who's just kind of like, you know, even though she's been a pro for a long time, you know, she's out on tour all the time with Alice Cooper. As a solo artist, I think her time is coming, you know. It's right. It's she's about to explode on the scene.
Yeah, Dianita's awesome. Now, Dee Snider's got this petition out for AC/DC to play the Super Bowl. If you could pick someone to play the Super Bowl, who do you think it would be?
Oh, it would be me.
You?
Yeah.
Why not, right? That would be pretty good, I suppose.
Yeah, they probably can't afford me, so, you know.
Hey, real fast, the MTV Unplugged. Tell me a quick story about that.
Okay, so here's the thing. So I've got this record out, Flying in a Blue Dream, and crazy me, I'm singing on a couple of tracks.
Right.
The record company wants me to do videos for the vocal tracks. And MTV at the time, you know, you had to really deal with them. It was really under the table weird stuff. And so they came to us and said, look, we want Joe to be on this show called, you know, Unplugged. And if he doesn't do it, we're not going to play his new video. And so my managers came to me and they said, you got to do this thing. And I said, hey, let me just point out that I do not sing and play acoustic guitar. You know, like, I'm really just an electric guitar player. And I can kind of do it maybe in the studio, but I don't certainly do it in front of people. But they say, you got to do it. Like, otherwise, if we don't get this video on MTV, and then the record's going to tank and blah, blah, you know, usual record company coercion stuff that goes on. And so I said, okay, but I turned to my drummer, Jonathan Mover, and I said, Jonathan, you've got to come with me. I can't sit there by myself and sing and play acoustic guitar. It's like I just won't be able to do it. So he goes, well, what am I going to do? And I said, I don't know, play tambourine, just whatever. So then I say, well, okay, who else is on the show? And they go, Stevie Ray Vaughan. And I said, well, great. You know, we had played with Stevie maybe a year earlier. And so I said, great. And they say to me, and you and Stevie will jam at the end of the show. And I said, well, then I'll do it. I'm going to do it because Stevie and I get the jam. So I get to the show. This is a long story. I apologize.
That's
but
not a problem.
We're in California on tour for the Flying in the Blue Dream tour. We, after a show in like Reno or something, we take a flight to New York City. We get there in time to take a shower, go right to the studio. I walk in the door, and the producer says, oh, thanks for coming. By the way, you're not playing with Stevie Ray Vaughan. And I was like, what? It's like, that's the only reason why we came, right? So then Stevie comes walking in. He gives me a big hug and everything. He doesn't know what's been going on behind the scenes at all. And then he gets taken off to his dressing room. So then they bring us onto the stage, and the guy says to me, okay, so where do you plug in this guitar? And I said, I thought the show was called Unplugged. And he says, oh, yeah, but you have to plug in. And, of course, my friends had arranged for me to have this, like, 1920 acoustic guitar to play that was barely playable. And I said, well, there is no plug. There's no jack. or anything. You've got to mic me up. And they were freaking out. So they finally get all that put together, and somehow we got through the show. And I don't, I mean, if you've ever seen that clip, that is one nervous Joe Satriani there. Just
yeah, you strike me like the guy like Slash, you know, because he has all that hair and it's, because I don't think he likes to be in the spotlight, you know, and it's like he just hides himself behind everything, you know?
Yeah, and you know, and it's great because Slash is absolutely amazing. You don't want him to be uncomfortable, right?
Right.
You just want him to be Slash. So, but there I was not being the real Joe, and I think Jonathan and I were like so close to just breaking out laughing because we just thought we looked and sounded ridiculous. And but somehow we got through the show, and I just can't believe there's like it's on the internet and people can actually see it.
I know. Who would have thunk back then? I mean, everything lives on the internet nowadays. What do you got coming up for the rest of 2020? Obviously, you know, tour and stuff, you'll continue pushing shape shifting. Is there any plans to get back in the studio with Sammy and those guys, or any tours, or is that just on just hiatus for however long?
Yeah, well, the first thing, as you mentioned, is we've got a European tour that starts up in April.
Right.
That's a 2-month tour. And then we've got South America in the summer. And then we do a North American tour starting in late September. I believe that's when the dates kick off. And so we're excited about that. And we'll probably work through 21. I'm trying to see if we can do maybe some kind of a G3 in 21 as well. But I'm hoping that when Sammy gets back from his run, because he's going out with Whitesnake, and I think next week he's going to South America. So once he's done, then we'll check in with Chad, and we'll see what Chad's schedule is with the Chili Peppers. I know they just got back with John Frusciante. So it's crazy as usual, but we'll keep working it.
Yeah, Chad just played on Ozzy's record. Have you heard that record?
No, I've only seen the stuff that's, you know, come across Spotify and on TV and everything. So, the vibe is right. You know, the time is good. Everyone's, praying that Ozzy can stick around and to help us rock a little bit longer, you know. And so this is great that the record is coming out and meeting with great success.
Well, when you got Elton John and Slash and Duff and Chad Smith, I mean, how can you go wrong, really?
Exactly.
You know. Well, you can't go wrong with you, Joe. Always great to talk to you. Shape Shifting comes out on April 10th. And thanks so much for the time, and good luck with everything this year. And we'll see you next time you swing through the Motor City.
Oh, definitely. Thank you.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' on You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
Up next, it's Henry Paul from the Outlaws. Their new record dropped. It's called Dixie Highway. Henry, how's things?
Hey, I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing good. You know, it's weird, man. My career seemed to come full circle. I got on the radio 30 years ago, February 10th, and the only album vinyl cut I ever played was Green Grass and High Tide on the radio.
That's funny. Well, welcome back.
Well, thank you. You know why I did that? Because we didn't have it on CD for whatever reason at the radio station. And, of course, it was too long for a cart. So it's the only vinyl album I've ever played on the air.
That's so funny. Well, you know, this new record came out on vinyl. And it's the first vinyl record I've made since, 1986?
Wow.
85? I don't know. I haven't seen vinyl with my name on it in decades. So we were very excited to see the Gatefold album come out. We were very thankful to the label for committing to do that. It was quite an expensive commitment.
Well, vinyl, of course, is really starting to really ramp up. I got about 400 records. I got bit by the vinyl bug about 2.5 years ago. I'm kind of sick of technology, so I'm like, I'm just going to put these records on and let them play. So I buy a bunch of them. Do you collect any of that stuff or no?
Well, yeah, and honestly, and I hate to switch subjects here, but when we went in to make that record, we're kind of sick of technology, too. And we wanted to make a record that was familiar from the standpoint of musical personality and an organic message and an organic musical delivery that people could listen to and say to themselves, that sounds real to me. The drums, the guitar players, the singers. And I think we succeeded in making a really honest and very human musical presentation.
Yeah, it's funny how some of these bands, like, you know, I know you've probably heard the stories about, like, Foo Fighters and stuff. They go back and they record their records on, you know, tape sometimes or whatever. But it's kind of cool. Did you guys just go into a room and jam these songs out, or did you do them track by track? How'd it work?
No, exactly that. We would go into a room and we would all set up, and when the light would come on and we'd click the song in, and we'd all work the arrangement up, and we'd throw that sucker right down. Sometimes we'd get it on the first take. We'd always cut it a second and third time just to make sure we had it, but we would, with those long instrumental passages and everything, things just sort of happened as they happened, and we were all in there together slugging it out.
Yeah, the way it should be done, of course. I know there's just too much polish sometimes on some of these records. And I'm talking to Tom Kiefer later from Cinderella. Same type of thing. It's like they got in there and they recorded it, you know, warts and all, and let the chips fall where they may.
Well, yeah, you know, in popular music has become something different. And I'm not pointing fingers at, you know, any genre in particular, but I mean, it's just a different day. Now, listen, there are still some great bands out there, and there's still some really wonderful, you know, American organic music made. But the slick pop thing is intriguing in a certain way, but it has nothing to do with music for me. It's just more of a technical exercise in creation. It's not really, it has no heart or soul. I don't, you know, it's the halftime show at the Super Bowl did not speak to me musically. It was an eyeful to watch, but
right.
It wasn't something that I identified with musically, whereas, you know, Tom Petty, on the other hand, was a lot more sort of relevant to what the Outlaws are from the standpoint of real.
Right. You know, speaking of that, like, you know, with pop bands and different bands like that, there are a good chunk of bands coming out right now that are real, like from Michigan right here, you know, Greta Van Fleet, you got the Dirty Honeys of the world and stuff. Are you familiar with any of these bands?
Yes, I am. And you know, and you're right. There is a lot of great new music. And people, you know, they try and, you know, whine and complain and doom and gloom. And, you know, I don't know. If you can play and sing and you've got a song and you got something worth listening to, go make it and put it out there and roll the dice and take your chance and have some fun with it. You know, it's kind of like I grow a little weary of people criticizing everything when, in fact, you know, they can't write, they can't play, they can't, you know, they're fans, consumers, but they want to kind of run things down. And I don't know. Again, going back to the Super Bowl, it wasn't my cup of tea, but I'm sure those girls came off stage and they were pretty well spent. That was a pretty impressive presentation from the standpoint of their physical investment. But for us, you know, we do something different, and we know when we've got it right, and we felt like we got it right on this record, and we just continue to move the Outlaws musical brand up the road.
How important is it for you guys to release new music?
It's everything.
Hmm.
It gives us credibility. I mean, for a band that started 40-some-odd years ago, what would the point be to just continue to play songs from 1970s? I mean, we certainly have an obligation to play those songs in our show every night, but we also have an obligation to, you know, treat the brand with respect and put new music out there so that people can go buy new Outlaws records and get that feeling that they got in 1976.
Right.
When they'd run out and get Lady in Waiting or Hurry Sundown or, you know, it's just that is part of how we go about doing what we do. And we're lucky we still have the ability to write good songs and make good records off.
Mm-hmm. Where do you put the state of Southern rock today, back in the 70s and stuff? You know, you guys and the Molly Hatchets and, I mean, Lynyrd Skynyrd and all that stuff. Now maybe Blackberry Smoke and stuff. Is there some Southern rock bands out there you really like?
Well, there's some potential bands coming up that have a chance. You know, I mean, Smoke's having some success, and I'm really happy for them. of my peer group, you know, Charlie puts on a really good show.
Mm-hmm.
Skinner still has a good band. They put on a good show. You know, there are really positive things about the generation of musicians and bands that I came up with. I will, not because I'm a member of the band, but I put the Outlaws in a different category to a certain extent, just from the standpoint of the quality of music we write and the quality of the record we make on it, the consistency of the show we put out there every night. I don't know. I think that we're trying really hard, and I think that our effort is reflected in the music that we make and the music and the records that we put out there. So I'm pretty proud of the Outlaws, not just because I'm a member of the band, but because we work so hard to keep that bar high and maintain that level of professionalism and excellence.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, do you guys have some rock cruises coming up this year or no?
Not this year. We have the Rock Legends cruise next year.
Okay.
We were on it last year. I think they stagger it from year to year. We've been on Southern Rock cruises, and we'll probably be on those. And, you know, those things are kind of fun. You get out there in the warm climate in the middle of winter and get to go out on a boat and float around with your friends and have some fun and take a little bit of a vacation as you continue to work. And it's, they become really a fun part of our career.
Yeah, it's kind of funny how those things have kind of taken a root over the last 10 years. You know, you almost think, why didn't someone think of this sooner? I don't remember them being around in the 1990s and stuff.
No, it's a real cool idea, and it's really definitely very popular.
So last thing here for you, Dixie Highway, when people put this record on, I guess you probably already answered this question to a certain degree, but what do you think is going to strike them? I mean, the realism of it, you said the quality of songs. What's something that you expect people to take away from this record?
Well, I think two things. Number one, the message in the music. The storyline in the song is relevant and really well thought out and written idea. And number two, the faithful musical character to the Outlaws' musical legacy, that the band is in character and operating on a musical basis that is familiar and endearing to the fans. So they get what they want, they get what they expect, and they also get to enjoy the emotional investment of the songs we've written and the lyrics and the stories and what they have to say. So that's what I hope they come away from the record feeling.
That's cool. You know, I've been here in Detroit for almost 25 years, but I grew up in New York as well. I was out there outside of Western New York. So
we used to hang our hat.
Yeah. You were on the other side of the state, right? Were you by Watertown or somewhere?
I was born down the Hudson River in Kingston.
Okay. Yeah.
But I got out of Kingston when I was, 7 years old?
Oh, seven. Okay. Mm-hmm. I thought you were a little bit older than that. Okay. I was going to say, because I can hear that southern bit in your voice. So.
Yeah, we moved to Florida when I was in 1957, when I was like in the second, third grade. And I quickly assimilated my surroundings and learned the southern way of life, and it's been a good thing for me.
Well, awesome. Well, continued success. Good luck with the record, and next time you come up here through the Motor City, we'll have to stop by and say hello.
Well, that would be wonderful. Thanks for your time.
There you have it again, another 2-for-1 right here on the Talkin' Rock with Meltdown podcast. Got to thank Henry as well as Joe Satriani for checking in, doing the Satch Boogie with us here on the Talkin' Rock podcast. Hey, thank you guys again for listening, like I said. And this may be the last podcast I do using this old trusty Pro Tools rig. God, I love Pro Tools. It's like a little inside baseball here, but it's like Pro Tools is pretty much commonplace as far as a recording device, you know, that a lot of bands actually use in the studios and whatnot. I have one at my house. I like it so much. I've been using this thing for the last 15 years, and now we're switching platforms here at the radio station and doing all sorts of other things. So I'll be using a different platform coming up next time. So it might sound a little bit different, but we'll see what happens. Going to try to make as smooth a transition as possible. But like I said, I got Tom Kiefer locked and loaded coming up here within the next week or so. And then, of course, we've got the summer concert season coming up as well. We'll be talking to some of your favorite rockers all throughout the year. I usually average about 80 or 90 podcasts a year. So if you're a rock and roll fan and you like this kind of talk, definitely check back, subscribe as well. And, yeah, we'll be talking to a lot of them yet again this year. Hey, we'll let Joe Satriani play us out. It's the Talkin' Rock with Meltdown podcast. We'll do it all over again real soon.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.